Sorry to be a little late, but...
you had a lot to carry with you.
Couldn't get someone to help?
We don't have an exercise gym here, but we do. Sorry to keep you all waiting. We've just come from a very interesting meeting reviewing the state of our building project, and we're looking forward to giving you all some good news on that front before the year's over. Let me just give a few opening remarks as a kind of scene setter. I think you all understand that the fundamental mission of the Institute of Peace is an education and training mandate from the Congress to try to raise the competence level, the skill level of our country to deal with international conflicts without resort to violence. And we've gotten over the last decade much more heavily involved in operational activities. As I think you all know, we have an office in Iraq. We've been on the ground in Afghanistan. It all started with the Balkan situation. We did on-the-ground work in the Philippines. So this institution has added layers, but layers that are grounded on our analytical work and our fundamental education and training mission. And we're here today to recognize and have what I know is going to be a very interesting discussion on the sixth volume that has come out of the work of our former chairman, current board member, Chet Crocker, Pamela All, our vice president for education and training activities, and someone who unfortunately isn't here today, former senior fellow Fenn Hampson. Now that's a triple threat. For those of you who know baseball, we all remember Tinker to Evers to Chance. Well, it's Crocker to All to Hampson, as we've got this triple threat team that has produced a really remarkable set of volumes that really have restructured the way that issues related to international conflict and its management in the post-Cold War world has developed. So Leashing the Dogs of War, the most recent volume, and Chet, Pamela, and company can't seem to produce anything less than, 600 or 700 pages, is a very important addition to the intellectual work that they've done over more than a decade now. This effort began with managing global chaos. This institution, because of its small size and its mandate and the innovativeness of our staff, grabbed one of the first issues right after the Cold War ended, which was the humanitarian crises and the chaos that was coming about in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the discipline that the superpower confrontation had imposed on lots of conflicts around the world, particularly in the Balkans in the mid-90s. And we ran a major conference in 1994 that drew over 1,200 people, which for a small outfit, which had never done something like that, demonstrated there was a real demand for fresh thinking. And 2 years later, this volume came out that, again, made a major contribution to teaching about this changing world situation. Turbulent Peace came out a few years later, and in some ways it was a more hopeful volume. It came out, I should say, just before 9/11, and it implied that peace was possible. The world was still roiled by a variety of ethnic and religious conflicts and other sources of instability, but the word peace in the title demonstrated that the world seemed headed in a direction that at least looked to be manageable. But 9/11, of course, fundamentally changed our perspective on the world as we saw it going into the 21st century, and Leashing the Dogs of War, with the war word there emphasizing that there were going to be major challenges of which nuclear proliferation, the North Korea, Iranian challenges are only perhaps the most evident. So, and I should add that I meant to comment on this earlier, that Leashing the Dogs of War was preceded by a book called Herding Cats, which talked about the role of third-party mediators in dealing with a lot of these international conflicts. And I'm here to report that our colleagues are going to produce a third volume, Herding Cats, Leashing the Dogs of War. The third volume is going to be Cleaning Up After the Elephants. And of course, elephants is with a small E, right? Sorry, I just the world is a zoo, and what are we here to do today to celebrate this third volume? First is to review in what you will hear from our panelists of assessments of the current security environment, what has changed since the last major volume, that is Turbulent Peace, and to assess what are the most appropriate tools, diplomacy, soft power instruments, coercive power that can be used to manage the kinds of conflicts that we now face. And then also to look ahead a bit for the future challenges of conflict management and what both the United States as an individual country and the international community can do to deal with them. The title of the book, Leashing the Dogs of War, of course, is a play on the Shakespeare comment from Julius Caesar, where Mark Anthony calls to let slip the dogs of war. And this is an image that now calls on us to find ways to leash those dogs to get these conflicts under control. And again, we're very privileged to have a terrific panel here. Chet Crocker, I've already mentioned Chet, as for 12 years was our board chairman, and I think is an eternal member of our board, whether he likes it or not, but has been enormously productive. He's a Schlesinger Professor of Strategic Studies at Georgetown. Dan Byman, a colleague of Chet's at Georgetown, is the director of the Security Studies Program and the Center for Peace and Security Studies, and he'll open this panel by looking at the uses and the limits of military force. Our two other panelists, Barbara Slavin, who's with us this year as a senior fellow. She's a senior diplomatic reporter, or the senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today, and she's going to talk about one of the looming major confrontations, potential violent conflicts, that is our confrontation with Iran. And I'm told that today is the publication day of her new book entitled Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Past of Confrontation. And again, this will give us a taste of a reality that looms in front of us. Finally, Andrew Mack, director of the Human Security Report Project at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, a former senior U.N. official, and will talk to us about the role that the United Nations hopefully will play in dealing with a lot of these conflicts. I also should mention that in this volume you will see summarized or presented important work that other of our colleagues here at the Institute have carried out. Dan Serwer and our Executive Vice President Trish Thompson have a chapter that looks for frameworks for success in conflict management. Neil Kritz directs our rule of law work, has a chapter on promotion of rule of law. Paul Stairs and Mona Yacoubian have a chapter that looks at new approaches to thinking about the terrorism problem. And then Pamela, our Vice President for Education and Training, as I mentioned, has a chapter dealing with the non-official actors who contribute to international conflict management. So a very rich and heavy book, a very rich morning, and again, we're delighted you're all here. And Dan, why don't you start the show?
I'm talking this morning on the utility of force, but perhaps just as importantly, its limits. And I'll give kind of some generic thoughts on the current security environment and then talk about counterterrorism in particular and counterinsurgency, which are some of the tougher problems today. There's a standard list of security problems that Americans tend to think of. Iraq, of course, is probably prominent in the public mind. Terrorism, Al-Qaeda. And then you have nuclear programs, Iran and North Korea. This list, while rather frightening, is actually disguising the fact that in many ways the security environment for the United States is exceptionally benign today, and there are a tremendous number of good things going on that we're not paying attention to. And security, when you talk on security, like I do, your job is to emphasize the negative. So I'll be talking about problems. But I want to note some huge developments in the world over the last 25 years that are really shaping the security environment in fundamental ways. One is a lasting peace in Europe, which bears absolutely no sign of falling apart. It's expanded to Eastern Europe. So large swaths of the world are in a zone that seems, never want to say immune from conflict, but the probability of war seems exceptionally low. The number of democracies and peaceful democracies has risen dramatically over the last 50 years. Still a long way to go, but much of the world is better governed than it's ever been in human history. One of the most important things in the last 15 years has been the rise of China and India in a peaceful way. We can talk about tensions with both. There are tensions right now with the United States and India over a nuclear deal, but relations are pretty good. There's no imminent talk of war with these powers. And so what you have is a relatively, I don't want to say permanent, but long-lasting peace among the major powers of the world. And if you look back historically, major power war is what poses a threat to humanity and can lead to the deaths of tens of millions of people, arguably more today. So I don't want to say that the world is sweet and nice, but it's important to recognize this. And even in civil wars, which is the focus of much of the work USIP has done, the number rises and falls by the year. But in general, the trend has been downward since a peak in the early 1990s. So by a basic measure, which is the number of people dying violent deaths, and especially as a percentage of global population, the world has not gone, and we tend to see after 9/11 and Iraq from an American point of view, all these problems. Looking around the world, there are some very good positive trends going on. Okay, on to the question of military force. U.S. military force today is overwhelming in a way that the word overwhelming does not capture. The U.S. military budget is equal to more than the military budget of the rest of the world combined. And in military spending, you tend to get economies of scale. So as you spend more, items actually become cheaper. You can do things like carrier battle groups or very sophisticated air wings that are very hard to duplicate on a smaller scale in other countries. As a result, in land, sea, air, and space, in every dimension, the United States is dominant. So you have this tremendous conventional force advantage. There are certain areas, guerrilla war, terrorism, nuclear weapons, that the United States does not dominate in, and those are tremendously important. But it's very important to remember that in most areas where combat occurs, there's no competitor to the United States. And add to that, there's really no country in the world that has serious power projection capabilities. So there are countries that can fight on their borders or near their borders, but almost no one can send forces around the globe. And in fact, I would say no one can do it in the face of opposition by the United States. So this may change as China rises. This may change as India rises. I suspect it will. But right now, the U.S. conventional force advantage is tremendous. And as a result, many things are off the table. We talk about the possibility of a U.S.-China conflict, but it's not China sending forces around the globe to fight the United States. It's over a very, very limited conflict over Taiwan that, while extremely dangerous, could escalate. We're not even talking about a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. We're talking about largely uses of sea interdiction or missile uses, things that require China to go against U.S. forces in a rather asymmetric way. And this should be an area, this is right near China, very far from the United States. And even here, many things are off the table. And as a result, you see limits to states confronting the United States and actually states confronting each other in the face of potential U.S. opposition. Even things like state sponsorship of terrorism, which is a tremendous concern, are limited or often down by historic levels because states are concerned about the risk of escalation. Ironically, in terms of peace, nuclear weapons have often played a role of enforcing peace rather than going against it. That could easily change, and it's something I'm personally concerned about. But that said, they have been a force for stabilization in many parts of the world. The key way to think about this is what is not happening. Most people don't quite recognize this, but there is no conventional war today. There is no state-to-state conflict going on today. And in human history, that's a remarkable statement. You could say for most of human history, there's been some part of the world in a semi-perpetual state of war. And so that doesn't mean that states are not intervening in other states or not supporting unconventional conflict there. But again, certain things are off the table. States use proxies. They intervene in failed states. These are important issues. But I want to set the stage for this because we tend to focus on the world as if everything was Iraq, as if everything was al-Qaeda. When if you look around much of the world today from a point of view of military force, there's a lot that's not being done. Okay. The problem, though, is that for things like unconventional war, guerrilla war, terrorism, nuclear weapons, the use of conventional military force has tremendous limits. There are reasons that states have gone down this road, and it's in part because they recognize it's very difficult to challenge the United States in conventional military terms. This is the comparison I like to make is if I'm going to, issue a challenge to Tiger Woods, it's not going to be a golf game, It's going to be something different. And, doesn't mean he can't beat me at that, but I know the one thing is not going to be golf. And no one is going to challenge the United States going for air superiority at the moment or naval superiority. It would be incredibly costly, and they would probably lose. So unless this is a very long-term program like the Chinese where we're talking really generations, for the most part, we're looking at things where the United States does not have mastery, does not have dominance. So you see Iran, for example, and the classic term people use with Iran is it has an asymmetric strategy, meaning it's trying to hit the United States where the U.S. is weak. And that's true, but that's not a reflection necessarily of Iranian cunning or their Persian history of deception and manipulation. It's a recognition that they don't have conventional military power, and the Iranians are quite open about saying that. We can't challenge the U.S. Navy, so we have to go somewhere else. I will also say that in these challenges, the other side has some advantages. It's very difficult for the United States today to gain diplomatic support for the use of force. Not impossible, but it requires relatively dramatic conditions. In the near term, at least, to gain public support and congressional support for the use of force, there's also considerable skepticism. Also, provocations are likely to be calculated to be just under the bar of what the United States can take. The example I like to use is Khobar Towers, where 19 Americans died and nothing happened. And it was a correct judgment on the part of the Iranian leadership that you could do this and the United States would not hit back. And it's more complex than that. There's a lot that went into this decision. But that said, you can inflict certain casualties without a U.S. Response, and states are very good at recognizing where U.S. red lines are. Also important is casualty tolerance. Most governments in the world, especially non-democratic ones, are willing to take casualties at levels the United States is simply not willing to suffer. And lastly, they recognize that when we hit them militarily, they can drum up nationalism to their end. For talking about terrorism and state sponsors of terrorism in particular, there are some very, very strong limits. One is that terrorism is a very cheap weapon and works for low cost. Iran has used terrorism in part to prevent an Israeli-Palestinian rapprochement in the 1990s. Very cheap, very successful. A lot that went into the failure of peace, but one of the major factors was terrorism. Also, they can manipulate how they do sponsorship to avoid U.S. pressure. We tend to like labels, so Syria is a supporter of terrorism. But if Syria outsources it and has the training done by Hezbollah in Lebanon, it's hard for U.S. categories to deal with this bureaucratically. We put pressure on Pakistan in the 1990s to move away from terrorism, so they outsourced it to Afghanistan. There are ways states can manipulate our approach. But a big thing is that because states don't have conventional military alternatives, because they're often weak economically, they don't have many other instruments. So supporting guerrilla war, supporting terrorism, is tremendously important to them because the stakes are high for them. Kashmir for Pakistan, the Golan Heights for Syria, Iraq today for Iran, these are vital national security issues. And it's very hard for us to convince them not to go after this. A second to last point, which should be a bit of good news, is that it's also very hard to use force against ideologically driven states. Khomeini's Iran in the early 1980s, the Taliban's Afghanistan, Sudan in the early 1990s. These are states that supported guerrilla war and terrorism, in part because they saw it as the right thing to do. And they knew they were going to pay a price, and they didn't care that much. And in fact, when they did pay a price, it reinforced their sense of isolation and anger. I would argue today that there is not a highly ideological government in the world. There are some leaders that tilt a bit that way, one way or another, but you don't see revolutionary states, states that fundamentally are striving to change the world order for ideological reasons, with the possible exception of the United States. And this is something that is, not saying it's bad, I'm just saying it's, you don't see it that much. And that has huge implications. When you're going against terrorist groups in particular, exceptionally hard to use military force against them. The intelligence challenge is immense, finding particular individuals. You need real-time intelligence. You need the ability to have often planes overhead with spotting on the ground. And usually there's not that much to destroy. The infrastructure is limited. It's hard to find de-skilled personnel. And often they want us to attack. One of the best things that ever happened to al-Qaeda was the 1998 cruise missile strike in Afghanistan, where we have these kind of letters from camp from al-Qaeda folks in Afghanistan before and after, where they're saying before, Afghanistan's horrible, the Afghans are cheating us, no one likes us, I want to go home. And after the attacks, they're saying, we're heroes. We're starting to get lots of money, we're starting to get lots of recruits. And it's because, again, going back to this idea of a challenge, no one expects them to beat the United States in a fair fight. What people are looking for is a form of defiance. And because the U.S. military was engaged, they could say successfully that they were engaging the United States at strength and winning in a way. Okay, some implications very briefly. One is that the name of the game for much of counterterrorism, in my judgment, is really counterinsurgency. A lot of the strength of al-Qaeda, where it's really dangerous, comes from these insurgencies around the world that churn out kind of the resources you need for a successful terrorist organization, a successful large-scale one. So Iraq, tribal parts of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Algeria, Chechnya, these are very nasty places. No one wants to be a counterinsurgency. But that's, to me, part of the name of the game. And if you're talking about the role of military forces, to me, a big role is training militaries, other militaries, to fight counterinsurgencies more effectively. In particular, I would add training local police. And this is something bureaucratically we've shunned, but a tremendously important role that right now the U.S. government is not doing. Another major role of force in this is killing individual terrorist leaders and key operatives. And this is something we haven't had much of a debate on in the United States, which is the U.S. government is back in the business of killing people on a select basis. And I think that as a democracy, we should actually be talking about this. I suspect people in this room would disagree as to whether we should be killing lots or a few or none. But that's the whole point, is we're supposed to resolve that. My concern is our policy will oscillate and even vacillate because we don't have a consensus, because it simply isn't being discussed by either party. Diplomatically and from an intelligence point of view, we need a very different structure for these challenges. We need our structure to be global in a true sense, because problems may break out in, whether it's Somalia or Ethiopia or Yemen, but they will break out in places that are not traditional allies where we have a robust presence. But in particular, they'll break out in parts of those countries where our people aren't. So even in Pakistan, where we have a significant presence in Islamabad, what we actually care about are more remote parts of Pakistan. And we need that diplomatic presence. It requires a very different approach to how we do business, because you're much more focused on local conditions than the national government. The last recommendation I would say is an emphasis on domestic resilience. Right now, we have almost no system in place for reassuring the American public after there's an attack. If there is, say, a radiological attack with a dirty bomb, I can tell you with some degree of certainty that far more people are going to die in the panic and driving out of Washington than would die from the actual explosion device. And that's a government failure. Politicians of both parties seem to have seen their job as making the panic worse rather than trying to reassure people. And that's something that you can't completely stop, but you can do a reasonable job of having the public voice be reassuring rather than alarming. And the last thing I'll conclude with is, you see, I got to the negative again. You know, I focused on Iraq and terrorism, all these things. But right now there are some real benefits to U.S. military hegemony, and there are some real benefits to the security situation in the world today. And if you take some things off the headline, in particular Iraq, I think the world would look much safer to Americans. And it's in part because there are many developments in much of the world that are going well that, simply because they're going well, they don't receive the coverage and attention they deserve. Thank you.
Terrific opener, Dan. And I said, we've got a big problem where there's so many interesting issues that are inherent in what we've just heard. If we stopped and opened the floor, we'd probably never get through. Let me just say, you know, what about the future of Russia? Mm-hmm. Is there not going to be a problem there? In terms of U.S. military dominance, you mentioned insurgency, but what about the asymmetrical capabilities, the nuclear proliferation problem, information warfare, and then energy security? We'll get off into these. I'll just give you a sense of some of the richness that's provoked by Dan's presentation. The way we'll proceed is our other presenters will present, and then we'll open the floor. You'll see two microphones, and the drill is you should come up to the microphone and direct your question to an individual, assuming you have a specific question. Chet Crocker, next on the agenda.
Thank you very much. I'm going to stand and hope that my voice carries. Is the mic on so we can all hear? Okay, good. Well, Dan has provided the perfect launch by underscoring the utility, the limits, the applicability in the current international environment of military instruments. I'm going to make a point of contrast by talking about the importance of statecraft and diplomacy, and hopefully emphasizing the necessary interaction and integration between coercive instruments and other instruments of statecraft. I also want to thank Dick for his very generous scene setting of today's event, because we have in the room 8 authors who are in this book, so I just want to recognize them as well by welcoming you. And actually, Fenn Hampson, the co-editor, is en route. I'm not sure he's arrived yet. If he's arrived, it's covertly. But some editors are more covert than others. The basic thesis I want to speak to is that when it comes to statecraft and diplomacy, we are, in the current period, suffering something of a diplomacy deficit. My argument is that this is a long-standing and deeply rooted bipartisan problem, deeply rooted in American culture, political culture, and also deeply rooted in our strategic military culture. And Dan and I haven't rehearsed this, but I'll be very interested in what he might say in response, and I'll indicate why in a moment, Dan. Statecraft and diplomacy is something which, of course, American governments have done historically, successfully, in many different times and places and under many different administrations. I don't think I need to go beyond just mentioning the creation of the Bretton Woods institutions, the UN, the opening to China, which our President Dick Solomon had a thing or two to do with, the disengagement on the Golan, the Camp David Accords, the peaceful winding down of a lot of Cold War conflicts, the more or less peaceful breakup of the Soviet Union, the German unification, the road to Dayton, and more currently, the North-South Agreement in Sudan, which is a pretty impressive piece of statecraft. It needs a lot of follow-up, and it is in some jeopardy at the moment, but nonetheless, it was a significant accomplishment of statecraft, the bringing in of Muammar Gaddafi from the cold, and as to such an extent that perhaps our Secretary of State will be paying a warm visit out there in the not-distant future. She's very busy, and she reminds us that she's busy and that the United States is a busy country. But one hears One hears that there might be a visit to Libya coming up, the recent Korean Peninsula negotiations. I mean, so we have current examples as well as past examples. But my basic point is that we don't do enough of it, that we don't emphasize to the extent that we should the full range of the full toolkit of what I would call tools of statecraft, and that there are reasons for it, that the word diplomacy is, in fact, stereotyped as a kind of bumper sticker. It's the other thing that American populists often go after along with the United Nations, and we're going to hear from Andy Mack about the United Nations in a moment. We'll look forward to hearing that. But when Americans like to take off on something they really don't like in our foreign policy, it's either the United Nations or it's diplomats or it's the State Department. You know, the other day I'm listening to NPR in the shower, And
that's dedication.
Yeah, yeah. The best place to listen to NPR. And they're interviewing a captain serving in just south of Baghdad someplace. And how's the surge going? And the captain says the surge is going just fine. The problem is on the civilian side. We can't get the sewers to work. And where is the State Department? Now, the last time I checked, it wasn't a Bureau of Sewers in the Department of State. But you get my drift, you know. So we need smart statecraft. And there's discussions in this book and other places about what statecraft consists of. It's a combination of wits, wallets, and muscle, using all forms of power, including hard power, and using hard power intelligently, integrated into an overall strategy where the parts fit together. It's connecting the dots is what basically statecraft is. But as Dan Byman has so eloquently pointed out, we are particularly good at connecting the military dots rather than connecting the military dots to the civilian dots or the political and the diplomatic and the military all together. Diplomacy is really like the engine or the transmission belt that converts leverage and power into political results. And one wishes that we had more frequently that kind of a discussion at senior level so that people could see how all this fits together. Unfortunately, people see diplomacy as something that means like talking nice to people or giving them concessions. We shouldn't talk to the Syrians because they'd ask us for something or we'd have to give them something. Completely ignores the point. I mean, what people are really saying is that they don't want to be seen talking to Syrians because it would imply that we might accept them or accept them as a negotiating partner. This misses the point. When you engage with someone diplomatically, you're not giving them something. You're probably challenging them to think about things they would prefer not to have to think about at all. You're putting questions in front of them. You're actually upsetting their comfort level. And that's the kind of public discussion which we need more of. Like, for example, questions like, what would it mean to you to have a better relationship with us or with them? What would you pay for it? What are you prepared to put on the table if they put something on the table? That's what a diplomat does. A diplomat doesn't walk in the room and start opening his or her wallet. Or you might ask questions like this. What do you need from us in order to behave better yourself? What are your political requirements for laying down arms and becoming a political actor? The kind of question that comes up again and again and again in the much fraught Middle East discussions that we have. Now, why do we have, we in Washington, why do we have this problem with statecraft and diplomacy? One part is American political and popular culture. We are so very powerful, as Dan has indicated. We are used to analogies to sports. If we're the best team in the NFL and we don't win, what the hell's the matter with us? We're used to thinking of the international arena rather like the sports arena or like the Wild Wild West or whatever. So there's a lack of candor in the way our political elites sometimes talk to the American people. But the second problem, and here's where I hope at some point, if not today, later, that I will hear a reply from Dan Byman, is that our strategic and military culture is so good at winning battlefield victories and so poor at translating battlefield victory into political success. That is the problem, and we've seen it time and time again in the post-Cold War period, in the Korean War, and other times in our history. We just don't connect the dots very well. Okay, so I think you have a sense that I see a problem out there, and that we need more statecraft than we have, that we are capable of doing it periodically on occasion, but we don't do it often enough, and we could do more of it, and it would make a better service for American national interests and for international security if we did. All right, so what's the answer? What's the remedy? Apart from having leaders who will speak a little bit more directly, candidly, openly, and honestly about the full panoply of assets that we have in our toolkit. What is the answer? Well, the first answer is to increase the USIP budget. Let me move right on to that. You got that all written down, okay. The next answer is that I think we should be redefining this thing called the global war on terrorism. And I know there are officials in the executive branch who are reworking and readapting those words and so forth. I'm actually impressed by a pundit who recently remarked that never mind our global war on terrorism, they are waging a war on us. Okay, fine. They continue to wage a war on us. That doesn't mean we have to elevate them to the status of the former Soviet Union and declare a war on them, which in fact dignifies them, legitimizes a bunch of, I won't use the terms I would like to use, but these jihadis are not worthy of being the target of an American-led war. Let's redefine our terms and let's get beyond this phony duality that we seem to have of a bipolar world. There's a lot of other foreign policy to conduct, and we need to fight this struggle with the bad guys in a more intelligent way. Dick made reference to a chapter in Leashing the Dogs of War by Paul Stairs and Mona Yacoubian about using our brains as well as our guns in the war of ideas that's taking place within Islam. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. But in addition to fighting that struggle more intelligently, we have a lot of other issues to deal with. We have intractable conflicts to deal with, which are often the breeding ground for things unpleasant, as we know, whether those are conflicts in Sri Lanka or in southern Philippines or in the Horn of Africa. We have regional security challenges in places like Northeast Asia, like Central Africa, like the Middle East, that we should be dealing with. The question of regional security structure or architecture in the Gulf, which I know Barbara will want to say something about, is obviously an important issue. We have failed states to deal with. We have the question of governance of the global commons to deal with. We have post-conflict reconstruction to deal with. We have the collapsed NPT regime to deal with. There's a lot out there besides this global war on terrorism. So, and then the final point, of course, about the over-focus on the GWAT, as it's sometimes called in town, is that it distorts our capacity to do what I think a number of us writing in this book feel needs to be done, which is conflict management. If the only thing that we're thinking about in a kind of bipolar model is going after terrorist bad guys, it reduces our focus on our third-party role in conflict resolution. It distorts the marketplace. When you're in the market for allies or adversaries in a war on terrorism, you'll find both of them. So we've got to be careful about overdoing and skewing our priorities. It changes the regional playing field, whereas, in fact, if we did it right, the tools that we use in the war on terror could be used for lots of other conflict management challenges, like winding down failed states, dealing with criminal business enterprises that often promote failed states. So it's a rich agenda out there. We need a broader focus. We are capable of doing a lot more in the conflict management field than we actually do. And let's now hear from Barbara Slavin about how some of these thoughts and her own thoughts and many other things can be used for a discussion of Iran. Over to you, Barbara.
Thank you very much. I think I'll stay here if that's okay. I agree with a lot of what you just said, a lot of what Dan Byman said as well. I particularly like your idea about using the full toolkit. I think when it comes to Iran, we've seen sledgehammers, but we haven't seen anything really more subtle. And there are other instruments in that toolkit that could have been used. I want to thank USIT, first of all, for bringing me here. It says USA Today on the name tag there, but I have started a fellowship here, and I'm going to be working on expanding some of the research that I did for my book. I've been very lucky. I've been able to go to Iran 6 times, and I've met scores of ordinary Iranians, and I've met the current president and the last two, and had an access to them that I'm sure real diplomats would in the United States would enjoy having. Unfortunately, as you know, we haven't had that sort of contact for nearly 3 decades. Iran certainly presents one of the most complex challenges that we face today for U.S. foreign policy. For the past 30 years, our countries have been in a state of tension, if not outright conflict, sometimes not so pronounced, at other times verging on open warfare. At the same time, there have been opportunities for dialogue and diplomacy, and there has been diplomacy, and there has been dialogue. I think the question now is whether these tensions can be managed in such a way as to increase the chances of stabilizing the Middle East and influencing Iran to embrace policies more favorable to the interests of the United States and its allies. The theme of the book that's coming out today, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, is one of lost opportunities, missed opportunities. But the fact that there have been those opportunities should give us hope that there will be other chances in the future, although it's discouraging to think about what might have been. Talking generally about adversarial relationships of this sort, I think there are at least 3 options. Some of them have been discussed. I'm sure we can think of others and combinations of them. The first is military. A direct military confrontation with Iran against elements of the Iranian government, military installations, the nuclear program, the Quds Force, and so on. We've been hearing a lot of talk about this in Washington lately. It seems to be bubbling up more and more. But I think it's fair to say that even those who insist on maintaining this option are not enthusiastic about it. The downsides of using military force against Iran are obvious in terms of alienating Iranians, many others around the world, pushing the price of oil over $100 a barrel, provoking Iran to step up proxy wars against U.S. interests in Iraq, Lebanon, Afghanistan, and Palestine. The consequences domestically in Iran could be dire for the prospects of reform. It could set them back for another generation. Ahmadinejad has to run for re-election in 2009, and a U.S. attack could help his prospects. And it's difficult to see how the United States can stabilize Iraq or even maintain civil relations with the Maliki government if it attacks the largest Shiite country. Another possibility, another option, is intensified containment. And right now, this appears to be the preferred option in Washington. The Bush administration is pushing for more unilateral sanctions, United Nations sanctions against Iran. It's going after Iranians in Iraq. It's also planning major arms sales to Iran's Arab neighbors, in particular Saudi Arabia. And in some sense, even the Middle East Peace Conference that's going to take place in Annapolis next month is part of a strategy of containment. One aim is to undercut Iran's appeal to the Arab street as a champion of the Palestinians by showing that the United States also cares about the Palestinians. I think it's ironic in a way that it's taken a rising Iran to provoke the administration to do something that many of us thought they should have been doing a long time ago, which is trying to promote Arab-Israeli peace. And the Iranian leadership currently clearly understands the implications of a successful peace conference, and they've been advising Arab states not to attend. And I think it's likely that one will see a rise in violence from some of their proxies in the run-up to this conference to try to ensure that it doesn't succeed. The third option with Iran is direct negotiations, and which could be combined with containment. We already are seeing now belatedly talks on Iraq between our ambassadors in Baghdad. So far, though, they've amounted mostly to an exchange of accusations and talking points. The Bush administration has said that it's willing to enter into more comprehensive, higher-level talks with Iran, but only if it suspends its uranium enrichment program, and so far that hasn't happened. What's frustrating, I think, is that we've actually gone backwards on this track with the Iranians. Some of you may know that there actually were authoritative, high-level talks between the United States and Iran that took place in Paris and Geneva from 2001 through May 2003. Also in May 2003, there was an authoritative Iranian offer for comprehensive negotiations between the two countries. The Bush administration shut down the talks in Europe after they were publicized by myself, among other journalists. I feel somewhat ashamed now that they were embarrassed by the revelation that they were actually talking to the Iranians directly with no one else in the room. And then the administration never replied to the May 2003 offer. At that time, as you know, it was mission accomplished, and the administration thought things were going rather well in Iraq and that Iran would be the next domino to fall. Had that overture been accepted, had those talks been continued, it's possible we would have had a much better outcome. Mohammad Khatami was still the president. Iran had not proceeded very far in its nuclear program. And, of course, the U.S. was in a more favorable situation in Iraq in May 2003 than it is now. But we are where we are. Given the conditions that the Bush administration has set, it's difficult to foresee real negotiations until there is a change of administrations in both countries. Both sides are adamant on the issue of uranium enrichment, and it's unclear at this point whether the economic pressures on Iran are going to be sufficient to produce a change of nuclear policy. As long as oil remains over $80 a barrel and countries such as China and India are willing to replace Europeans in trading with and investing in Iran. And I'm also worried that some of the steps the administration is talking about, such as declaring the Revolutionary Guards a terrorist entity, will not contribute to a solution. The United States already has ample means to target the Guards and their various entities. And the Guards as a whole are a key component of the Iranian regime, intertwined with the conventional military and in many ways indistinguishable from it. Many of its officers and veterans hold important positions in the Iranian government and diplomatic service. And I had to laugh when I read that General Petraeus was complaining that the Iranian ambassador in Baghdad is a commander of the Quds Force in the Revolutionary Guards. And who else did he expect Iran to be sending to a country like this, which is in the middle of a civil war, and where Iran has very important security interests? He was surprised. I wasn't surprised. I think the goal for U.S. policymakers should be to try to find a way to integrate Iran into a regional security framework and to give it a stake in stabilizing the region. Admittedly, this is very difficult at this stage, but hopefully there's enough diplomatic expertise in this country and in Iran and in the region to make this possible. I frankly don't see any way in which the United States is going to be able to bring stability not only to Iraq but to Palestine, Lebanon, Afghanistan, without some sort of accommodation with the Iranians. Ironically, we had some of these understandings back in 2001, and it helped to overthrow the Taliban in Afghanistan, to stabilize that country, at least initially. And there were even understandings before the United States went in and removed Saddam Hussein. Condi Rice talks a lot about leverage, about wanting more cards to play. I think the United States has plenty of cards to play that are of importance to Iran. The country desperately needs investment in its oil industry. That's the ultimate card to play, certainly. And Iran has interests in groups like the Mujahideen Halk in Iraq, which the United States still has under its protection. This is a terrorist group that we're protecting in Iraq. Various other interests that the Iranians would want to see accommodated. So I would argue that instead of the sledgehammer, which seems to have been the approach, we should go back to finding something a little bit more subtle, something a little bit more malleable, and hope that it might work, if not in this administration, then in the next.
This may take a moment. Here we go. I'm delighted to be here today. Our students have read these successive six volumes year after year. It's very expensive for them because a new one comes out every couple of years. I'm also supposed to be saying something about the United Nations, where I worked as Kofi Annan's Director of Strategic Planning from 1998 to 2001. Any of you, those of you who know the UN know, of course, that the term strategic planning is a complete oxymoron in that institution. But what I want to say today is that notwithstanding the manifest failures of the United Nations in many, many ways, it's nevertheless an institution which, despite those failures, has made an extraordinary difference over the last 15 years since the end of the Cold War. I want to just go through very, very quickly and show you some of the data that we have pulled together to illustrate just what a difference the United Nations has made. This is a graph that just shows the number of armed conflicts in the world, and armed conflict being defined here as any armed confrontation which has 25 or more battle deaths a year. And you can see it's 1946 over the bottom there. In this period of so-called long peace, this is the period when major powers weren't fighting each other for an unprecedented long time, was actually an increase, a threefold increase in the number of armed conflicts around the world. And then in 1992, something extraordinary happens. Just at the point at which you have a number of writers beginning to worry about the explosion of ethnic violence around the world, the net number of armed conflicts in the international system starts to decline. It's been going down ever since. We show it, in a sense, leveling off over the last 2 or 3 years. But if you, in fact, these are just conflicts in which the state is one of the warring parties. If you add into that so-called non-state conflicts, conflicts between militias, between communal groups and so forth, there has been a much, much greater decline there. We only have data going back over 4 years. When we first presented this data, and we would presented it in about 1999, it wasn't this data, it was actually data by Monty Marshall, who's here, and his colleague Ted Gurr. Ted had written an article which was going to come out in Foreign Affairs. I circulated it through my colleagues at the UN, and it was greeted with absolute frank incredulity, because people in the UN said, are you mad? The 1990s is the worst decade ever for this institution. The 1990s is a decade of Srebrenica, the DRC, Rwanda, Somalia, etc., etc. And all of that is true. And it's also true that you actually see an explosion of violence in the 1990s, but you see an even bigger explosion of what one might call peacemaking, and that's been very effective. More conflict terminations than conflict onsets. To look again, just to look at this in regional terms, you can see over here, this is sub-Saharan Africa, the Americas, Asia, Europe, Asia, South Asia and Central Asia, Middle East and North Africa. So you can see that over this period, 2002 to 2006, there's been an extraordinary decline in armed conflict in sub-Saharan Africa. It's down by about 50% since 2000. A modest decline in the Americas, and the worrying areas, Central and South Asia and the Middle East and North Africa. But again, it's still a net decline. This is military coups, and again, you can see a pattern of very, very, very clear decline coming down here. The red is sub-Saharan Africa. The blue at the very bottom is the Americas. Huge decline in coups in the Americas, and most recently, a decline in sub-Saharan Africa as well. International terrorism. This is three data sets, two of which are funded by the United States. This is the National Counterterrorism Center. This one over here is the MIPT, the Memorial Institute for the Prevention of Terrorism. The yellow one over here is a new data set from the University of Maryland called START. They're all funded by the US government. And as you can see, they have remarkably different trends. And you can see there's this huge increase over here, going up to 20,000 deaths here and 12,000 deaths here. 70% of those deaths in these two data sets over here are accounted for by Iraq, which means that when the Iraq war is over, at least according to these two data sets, you're going to see a huge decline in global conflict. Note that instead of having 20,000 at the top, we now have only 8,000. We're talking about fatalities here. You can see the big spike of 9/11. If you take out 9/11, even if you don't, you can see that overall, for three of these data sets, there has been no real increase in terrorist fatalities since 1998. A modest increase in some places, a decline in others. So even if we're talking about terrorism, if we take Iraq out of the equation, and there are arguments for doing this, we can see that worldwide, particularly if we're talking about al-Qaeda, there hasn't been a major increase. Many people, when we show this data, say, well, you know, that may be true, there are fewer wars, but surely they're killing more people. And the answer is no, they're not. They're killing far fewer people. If you look over here, this is the peak over there, some 70-odd thousand deaths, sorry, 700, nearly 700,000 deaths. That's the Korean War, Chinese Civil War before that. Over here, nearly all of these deaths over here are taking place in Indochina. By the time you get to the 1980s, sort of death, war deaths are distributed a bit more democratically around the world. There's the Middle East, there's South Asia. As we come down here, a steady continuing decline with this big spike being sub-Saharan Africa, and in particular the Great Lakes region. If you look at it in number of battle deaths per conflict per year, it was around 37,000 per conflict per year in 1950. It's around 600 to 800 now. Note we're talking here about battle deaths in conflicts where the state is one of the warring parties. We don't have consistent data on not so-called non-state conflicts, but the data for the last 4 years show there's a decline there as well. This is not about indirect deaths. This is not about the 4 million people who have died as a consequence of war-exacerbated disease and malnutrition in the DRC. We have reasons to believe that those deaths are tending to be going down as well. Okay, very quickly. So first of all, I want to tell why there's been this decline in battle deaths, and then I'll talk about why there's been a decline in armed conflicts. The decline in battle deaths, the United Nations, no other institution can really take much credit for that. It is primarily about the changing nature of warfare, from large-scale conventional wars, which were both civil and international, very often with foreign intervention, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even in the 80s, and a shift to an increasing percentage of wars being low-intensity campaigns fought with relatively small armies who frequently sought to avoid military engagements and were fighting essentially with small arms and light weapons. And the last reason, and it's a rather odd one, is that between 1970 and 1990, the number of displaced people around the world increased from some 7 million to about 42 million. That was a humanitarian tragedy, but many of those people that left home saved their lives. So part of the decline in battle deaths is attributable to an increase in population. What about the decline in armed conflicts? One of the strongest findings to come out of the econometric literature is that increase in GDP per capita is perhaps the strongest factor we have for explaining, or one of the strongest factors we have for explaining the decline in armed conflict. But it's over a very, very, very long period indeed. If you look at East and Southeast Asia, you can certainly plausibly attribute some of the decline in armed conflict in that region to the extraordinary increase in economic development throughout the region. But if you're looking at what's happened post 1990 in the post-Cold War era, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where there's been this 50% decline, it is quite clear that economic development cannot be part of that explanation. End of colonialism removed one source of conflict from the international system, although of course it left behind a whole series of very, very fragile states with weak institutions, and very frequently colonial wars were replaced by struggles over control over the post-colonial state. End of the Cold War, critically important for two reasons. Reason number one, resources that were flowing to warring parties on both sides in the developing world, in conflicts in the developing world, simply stopped flowing. The Americans and the Russians said, okay, we're not doing this anymore. And that was really important. It's also the case that the end of the Cold War liberated the UN to do what its founders had wanted it to do in the first place, but never had. It never had. And it started doing a whole range of things that it had never, ever done before. And what you see subsequent to the end of the Cold War, and I'm just going to give you a series of snapshots, is across the board an extraordinary explosion of international activism. And this will just give you some flavor of this. Okay, this is humanitarian assistance, pretty important in terms of post-conflict peace building. You can see again here, we've gone from less than $1 billion up to around $9 billion. An extraordinary change, and the big acceleration comes at the end of the Cold War.
Is that inflation?
It is. It's 2003 figures. UN Security Council sanctions. Again, you can see over a period of time, not very effective, but an indicator of international activism. Special representatives of the Secretary General working in the field. Perhaps the best single indicator we have of UN presence. Again, you can see end of the Cold War, a steady and fairly dramatic increase. Groups of friends. Great book out from the USIP by Teresa Whitfield, who I know very well, worked closely with her on groups of friends. That's those coalitions of interested parties that help countries as they're A, to stop wars, and B, to help them emerge and through the post-conflict peace-building process. We can see over here, this is the total number of these missions, and then the blue line over here is peacemaking, trying to get wars to stop. The blue line is post-conflict peace-building. Incredibly important, almost nothing written about it before Teresa's book came out, and it came out just a few months ago. Finally, just to say a little bit word about conflict terminations and failure preventions. It's very, very clear that the number of wars can go down either because you've got fewer terminations or because you've got more terminations or fewer onsets. And what we see over this period over here is throughout the Cold War, there are slightly more onsets, that's the blue color, than there are terminations. And then we actually see the post-Cold War period. And you see, first of all, there's been this extraordinary increase in onsets. So people who believe that the end of the Cold War was associated with a huge increase in armed conflicts are absolutely correct. Numbers double compared to the 1980s. But you also see an even greater increase in terminations. And most of the terminations take place in the second half of the decade, and most of the onsets take place in the first half of the decade. Now, what does this suggest to us? What it suggests is that conflict prevention has basically been a failure, because whatever conflict prevention measures were out there, they certainly weren't succeeding in stopping wars from starting. And we can see that even when we come over here, this is the number of onsets, that's still higher than it was in the 1980s. And if you look at whether you're looking at the Friends, whether you're looking at the SRSG missions of the Secretary General, you will see that conflict prevention always has a relatively small number of missions, whereas peacemaking, trying to stop ongoing conflicts, appears to be much, much more successful. Not only peacemaking, but post-conflict peace-building. Post-conflict peace-building is particularly important because, and there's an argument about this in the literature, but somewhere between 30 and 50% of armed conflicts that come to an end start again within 5 years. So anything you can do to stop wars restarting is an important conflict prevention measure, and that's what peace-building is about. That's essentially what the UN and these other elements of the international community are about. And my final point would simply be to say that if it's the case that notwithstanding all the screw-ups, notwithstanding the lack of resources, notwithstanding the inappropriate mandates that are frequently the case with the United Nations, and notwithstanding the horrible politics of the Council, you can have this sort of impact, imagine what it would be like if we had appropriate mandates, adequate resources, and less horrible politics. I'll stop there.
If you want to take your...
I'll leave it. I'll come pick it up later.
Again, a terrific set of presentations. We have 45 minutes at least for a discussion. Let me just begin by opening up for the panel and see if there's any issues that our panel members would like to address to one another for a couple of minutes, and then we'll invite people to come to the microphones.
I think I'll begin actually by trying to answer a question that Chet raised, although when Chet is puzzled, lesser minds like mine are definitely doomed here. He asked the question of American strategic culture and the disjuncture between our ability to produce battlefield victory yet secure a post-war peace. I agree with this statement, and let me talk about several possible explanations. One of the most obvious is that the money is imbalanced. I mentioned that the Pentagon budget is larger than the military budgets of the rest of the world combined. The State Department budget is basically a rounding error in the Pentagon budget, and that's really not an exaggeration. I mean, that's, if you look at the figures, you're talking several orders of magnitude difference. And there are reasons for this in terms of what certain systems cost and so on. But a lot of it, I think, reflects the U.S. comfort zone, where there's a real reluctance in both Congress and the executive branch to fight for the State Department's budget. And I would add, frankly, there's a real reluctance in the State Department to bother with the dirty work of fighting for its own budget. And I think that state has historically neglected that mission. And that's something, I mean, right now, state could be making a very strong public case saying, you want us to be present in Iraq? You want us to do this massive, almost unprecedented surge there? Okay, it's going to cost. It costs us a lot, and do what the Pentagon is very good at doing, which is it doesn't just cost us X dollars per soldier to deploy. It costs us a lot more to sustain capability, to build it, to grow it, and so on. And state has historically not put the effort in. And, you know, I would put the primary responsibility with Congress and the broader executive branch, but I would add the State Department to that. A second reason is that the interagency process is often weak. The whole point of the interagency is to try to balance different instruments of national power. But that is, it's something that looks very good on paper. But in practice, has rarely been achieved that effectively. Multiple administrations, not just the current one, have struggled with this problem. But the last thing, and probably the most important, is I actually think it's much harder to secure the lasting peace than it is to gain the immediate victory. I could tell you as a social science on things like building democracy, sustainable development. We have lots of ideas, but they're somewhat untested. They're certainly not specific enough to be applied immediately to many conflict areas. And they require massive time and resources. So to say, you know, if you magically turned over a rock to a team of social scientists, I don't think you would have this, you know, wonderful recipe for success there. So I think that while we can fault the people who are trying to do this, there's also a problem with our generic state of knowledge.
A quick comment and a question for Andy Mack. The comment is that we have yet another new book out, which is not ours, it's Dan's, and I just thought it might be appropriate for us to recognize that Dan's got a wonderful new book out called Five Front War, A Better Way to Fight Global Jihad. So, Dan, congrats on that. I wanted to ask Andy Mack a question. In talking about the explosion of peacemaking during the 90s and even up to today, you had excellent charts and graphs on international organizations and the UN specifically. My sense is, and I'm sure there are a lot of people in this room who might wonder, that there's also a non-governmental activism dimension to all this, and I wonder if you've ever seen any decent data sets or could give us a sense of what role does the non-official community or communities play in this explosion of peacemaking? How much impact is this a competition? Is it a crowded playing field? How do you see the relationship between official and non-official actors? A point that is featured in a number of chapters, Unleashing the Dogs of War, not least the Pamela Auld chapter and some other chapters where we look at non-official power. So what do you think about that?
I think that NGOs play an absolutely critical role. A lot of work that was previously done by donors is being outsourced to NGOs because NGOs are cheaper in many ways. There isn't any good data on it, as far as I know. In fact, a huge amount of what NGOs do seems to escape any sort of systematic accounting. I mean, for example, we hear that humanitarian NGOs are becoming increasingly targeted, and yes, there is some evidence to suggest that there are more humanitarian NGOs being targeted, but nobody had ever gone back and actually looked and tried to find out how many humanitarian NGOs, how many personnel from humanitarian NGOs were actually working in the field. No one knew until a study was done by the Center for International Cooperation, which showed, yes, indeed, the number of people being killed in humanitarian NGOs working in conflict zones had doubled since 1998, but the number of people working in the field had more than doubled since 1998, so the number of people being killed per capita out there hadn't changed very much. That was indicative to me of just how little we actually know about the NGO community. It is governments don't track NGOs. NGOs are really bad at tracking themselves. It's the same problem that we have with respect to impact evaluations of NGO action. Extraordinarily little, and what is done is very bad.
May I ask a question of Barbara? Barbara, I want to ask you, assuming magically, whether it's the Bush administration or new administration, kind of heeds what I thought was one of the messages of your talk about the desirability of engaging the Iranians diplomatically. Mm-hmm. What can we realistically expect the Iranians to give up, if we want to call it that, at this mm-hmm. point? Or are there concessions that they're likely to make, in your view?
Well, I mean, if you look at the 2003 offer that was presented, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, it's reprinted in the annex to my book. This was put together by Sadiq Karazi, the nephew of the Iranian foreign minister who was Iran's ambassador in Paris for a long time, and Tim Guldeman, the Swiss ambassador in Tehran, who frequently came to the United States and was very aware of U.S. concerns about various issues. It was massaged a bit by Javad Zarif, who at that time was the deputy foreign minister. He had not yet become Iran's UN ambassador, but he had a lot to do with it as well. It was faxed from the Swiss embassy in Tehran to the Swiss embassy in Washington, and it was hand-delivered to the State Department, not faxed to the State Department, as some accounts have put it. And it is an extraordinary document. It lists an agenda of Iranian aims, an agenda of U.S. aims, and then it has a procedure for announcing the decision to begin substantive talks and, you know, with simultaneous announcements in both capitals. It's really a great document. It's got all the issues that anybody could be concerned about, the nuclear issue. It talks about terrorism. It talks about Middle East peace, Hezbollah, you name it. It's all there. So, I mean, the issues are well known. It's sort of like the Arab-Israeli conflict. Everybody knows what the three key issues are, you know, between the Palestinians and the Israelis. I don't think the agenda would be in dispute. The question is whether there is now a level of trust or confidence sufficient to begin these talks. And, of course, the U.S. and now the international community has put down a very big precondition. The UN Security Council has stated that Iran must suspend its uranium enrichment program before these talks can begin. And the response of the Iranians has been to accelerate their program and to try to achieve a fait accompli. I had to laugh, you know, in the spring of 2006, even last year, a lot of people were running around the State Department reading a new book by Margaret Macmillan, Nixon and Mao. And this was required reading for people who were dealing with Iran in the State Department. And, you know, you read, Dick Solomon knows well, the history of how the U.S. had its breakthrough with China. And then you look at what this administration has been trying to do with Iran, and it doesn't comport. One of the key issues, I think, one of the ways in which the Bush administration has fallen down on the job, and even the Clinton administration to some extent, is that it's not been willing to accord public legitimacy to the Iranian government as a whole. Clinton administration would always direct its overtures to Khatami because he was a nice guy and he didn't have blood on his hands. It had great difficulty dealing with the Iranian government as a whole. Madeleine Albright, when she gave this speech in 2000, referred to the elected and the unelected portions of the Iranian government. And we've seen this intensify under Bush, where he not only does he not recognize the Iranian government, but he's actually called for the people of Iran to rise up and overthrow it. So to expect, bless you, to expect any kind of serious negotiating process when you have one party to it not really accepting the legitimacy of the other seems to me far-fetched. But I had to compliment you with your notion that the U.S. has a more ideologically driven government than Iran right now. I would agree, and I would say that the U.S. actions in the Middle East, particularly the overthrow of Saddam, have revived what was a dying revolution and has provided new encouragement. That, plus the price of oil, has given new fervor to those in the Iranian system who want to spread their ideology.
While folks who want to raise questions are queuing up, let me just make two comments. We've been thinking here about ways we could get the Russians to present a strategic threat to Iran and create the dynamic that led to the breakthrough with China. Unfortunately, Mr. Putin, as we know, is in Tehran today, and the dynamic hasn't played out the way we had hoped. The other thing I might just mention, one of the interesting challenges for our country is to see the culture of the State Department transformed. And one of the things that we at the Institute will be developing, and you'll be hearing, seeing a lot more of this over the coming years, is that we have been entrusted by Congress to develop training programs that if under leadership of Chet and Pamela and Mike Lexon, we get foreign service officers, NGOs, military working together as a cadre oriented towards preventive action, towards post-conflict stabilization, that will hopefully bring about the kinds of changes that you're talking about. But it it requires a fundamental change in the self-concept of the Foreign Service officer, willingness to work, and I would say to some degree the military. We heard the comment about that, where's the State Department? And one of our opportunities, since we are a convening mechanism, is to get these communities to work together and to get the professionals in all these fields to see their roles in somewhat different way. Well, Phoebe?
Phoebe Maher, former USIP fellow. A couple of questions. First, perhaps to Dan. You've talked about U.S. hegemony as having some benefits, but I'd like to get your reaction and your thoughts on this aspect of it, whether it's because we projected this hegemony in a unilateral way, which is, of course, had repercussions on our credibility, and I'm perfectly aware of the Iraq issue. There is another theory also that says the world doesn't like hegemons, and that if there is one, it's going to balance against it. But I wonder if you have any thoughts on this whole issue of our sole superpower status in the world today, our incredible apparent lack of credibility, which is impacting our ability to use the diplomatic instrument, and so on. How much of this can be improved or dealt with by better policy, and how much of it is intrinsic to this status? And I'd just like to pick up a bit on Barbara, if I may, a second question. What do the Iranians want? Now, I realize that's not the simple question. It sounds there may be many Iranians and so on, but we hear a lot about them wanting to feeling their oats, quote-unquote, wanting to be a hegemon, or is it simply status quo protecting the regime? And we do hear that despite from time to time overtures, there's a strong group in Iran that doesn't think it's in its interest to come to terms with the great power.
A very tough question about the kind of power of the United States today and the reactions to it. There is a very fierce debate among academics, which several dozen people have read, on this issue and what is the response. Let me say a few thoughts. The sense in the 1990s was that part of the reason there was no reaction to the United States having such dominant power, it seemed relatively minor, was that the United States had deliberately bound itself with various institutions, that although the United States had tremendous strength, it had allowed itself to be constrained by international institutions, by acting multilaterally, and so on. With the Bush administration, the perception is this has gone away, and we can debate how multilateral the Clinton administration really was and how unilateral the Bush administration was. But in any event, the perceptions are that the United States is far more unilateral today. The question is, can you change this perception back? Because people now look and say, you know, sure, there might be a Democrat in the White House who's very multilateral, but 10 years down the road, there might be another person who's very unilateral, and we as a nation have to prepare for that and prepare for that today. My sense is, though, that you actually can, if not put the genie back in the bottle, kind of shove its feet back in or somehow constrain it to a degree. In part, this is because there hasn't been tremendous balancing against U.S. power. You know, what are we, 16, 17 years after the end of the Cold War? We've seen lots of small steps by historic standards. We've seen things, other nations pushing back, a lot of rhetoric, not cooperating on things like sanctions on Iran, for example, things that are serious policy issues. But we're not talking kind of the massive balancing we saw during the Cold War. We're not seeing any European military buildup that's at all serious. The military buildup in question seems to be China, but even that is not as alarming as it might be if China were, you know, seeming to go for broke. But that said, I see the rise of power of India and China in particular as leading them to develop militaries for a whole host of reasons, some of which are balancing the United States, but some of which have nothing to do with America. And that will, in effect, be a form of balancing. So I do see this as inevitable to a degree, but I think good policy can reduce it, can mitigate it, can limit its scope, and it's something I'm hopeful for.
What do Iranians want? Clearly, regime survival and perpetuation is the number one goal of those who are in power now. I think what they're looking for is a stable sort of detente situation, like that which existed between the United States and the old Soviet Union. They want acknowledgement of their role in the region. They want arms control talks. They want to be part of various regional security frameworks, maybe a GCC, not plus two, Egypt and Jordan, but a GCC plus three, including Iran, is not something that's impossible to imagine, since obviously the Gulf states, clearly the small Gulf states, have a lot of concerns with Iranians. They want an end to economic sanctions and pressure. I mean, it's remarkable that this country has been able to function the way it has under such comprehensive sanctions. The Clinton administration slapped total comprehensive sanctions on in the mid-90s and tried to get the Europeans to go along as well. And, of course, there have been increasing pressures because of the nuclear program. And their oil industry desperately needs renovation. They've got natural gas that they can't exploit. They don't know how to liquefy it properly. So there are lots and lots of pressure points, lots of leverage that the rest of the world has with Iran if it were to begin some sort of comprehensive negotiation. There is a group, yes, you're right, Phoebe, that sees the United States as vile and terrible and enjoys this state of hostility because they think it somehow helps to maintain revolutionary fervor. But I would argue that it's a very, very small group. I didn't mention, but there were other overtures, even after Mahmoud Ahmadinejad became the president, and Ali Larijani became their national security advisor. He's a very interesting character. He thought of himself as the Iranian Henry Kissinger. And he made overtures, very strong ones, in late 2005, early 2006. A deputy of his tried to set up meetings with Steve Hadley, never got an answer. Larijani even complimented Hadley. He called him a logical thinker in an interview that I did with him, which was about the best praise you can get from an Iranian. I think there was a period right around end of 2005, 2006, when the Iranians actually felt for the first time that they could sit down as an equal player because of the price of oil, because the U.S. was clearly bogged down in Iraq, and you know, Bush administration had so many other problems, and for the first time you had an endorsement by the entire regime, not just the reformers, of talks with the U.S. And Ali Khamenei even came out and endorsed talks with Iraq in March 2006, which, you know, supreme leader on the record. So I would argue that when they were finally ready, the administration decided it could not sit down mano a mano and ran away.
We'll alternate between the microphones. Bob Murray.
Thanks, Dick. Andrew Mack pointed out that in the United Nations, strategic planning was something of an oxymoron. And then some evidence that it's true on our side as well, perhaps. And I wanted to get the panel's view on whether Americans have the capacity to put together a long-term foreign policy, given our political system. The point that Chet Crocker mentioned about the military, actually the military at the moment are building some of those sewers over there, so they're not just they're not just trying to cope on the military side. But it seems to me it isn't really... sewers aren't really their strong suit or the things we ought to be looking to the military for. We need a capacity in other parts of our government, State Department for sure, different kind of State Department as Dick talks about, but also in other places, the Agriculture Department, the Justice Department, maybe a few other places. And we need to collaborate more with other countries because these are not just American problems. We have a leadership opportunity, a responsibility, but we don't have the complete responsibility for sure. So how do we take a longer-term view that involves bringing together the institutions of our governments and other governments, you know, over a sustained period to make better things happen in the world rather than the way we're now going about it? And we have the example of NATO, that we managed to put that together across administrations and across decades. But on other things, particularly more troublesome, difficult things that we're less familiar with, like Iraq, we do a much less good job. Thank you.
I'll go ahead and take a crack at it. Others may want to as well.
I think we're talking about several different kinds of issues here. I mean, we've seen successful planning and integrated strategizing, even in what some might call a diplomatically challenged administration. I think the case of the Libyans is a very interesting one because it involved NSC and State Department and the intelligence community working hand in glove, actually at times under a British lead with British intelligence and the Foreign Office to craft a strategy of engagement, if you like, on some very hot and difficult issues. And then it was done with skill. It was kept confidential because it had to be. It was very sensitive. There was some good luck, but it worked. So it can be done both within the government and across the Atlantic, which is a starting place. But I think the real answer to your question is so basic that it's almost pedestrian. This is all about human agency. This is all about individuals. It's all about leaders and people. And if they don't get their lieutenants to work together, it's because they don't want to bother to get their lieutenants to work together. And I've worked for administrations where lieutenants often didn't work together. And the president was just very reluctant to make them work together. So, you know, I've seen the other kind too. So it has a lot to do with leadership. One other point, which is alluding to the point that Dick was making about the importance of empowering our civilian agencies and our non-government capacities to do a better job of peace building and post-conflict. The real issue is how many Iraqs are we going to have? How many occupied or regime-changed countries are we going to have? How many failed states are we going to engage in? How many post-conflict transitions are we going to be the leaders of? And the question that's open, and I have not got the answer to this one, you'll be glad to know, is where does that point of leadership and coordination come from globally on picking up the pieces after a war to peace transition? Is it in New York, Andy? Is it in the EU? Can we hand off to anybody, or do we have to be always the one that people look to? Open question.
I'm Dick Ruffin with Initiatives of Change International. I have two questions quickly for Mr. Mack, could you give us your take on the prospects for the Peace Building Commission, the UN? Don't hear a lot about it, but I'd like to know what you think future prospects are. Maybe for Chet, but the question has already been addressed. The potential for policy-level collaboration between major countries, as well as involving non-state actors, in formulating options, at least, even if our leaders are not willing to take up a good option. Is there policy-level work being done across national boundaries and with private sector to develop reasonable options in some of these difficult situations, failed states, Somalia, I mean, so many, you can go on. But I'm aware of the struggles of interagency collaboration to get anything done, but how about formulation of options that could be put to a willing leader if we had one?
Peace Building Commission, it is an institution on which huge expectations have been placed, and it has no chance of meeting any of those expectations. When it was originally, the original idea came up, there were supposed to be 23 professionals working in the Peace Building Support Office, which is the critical part of the Commission in terms of actually getting things done. The General Assembly, in its wisdom, cut that down from 23 to 15 and said half of those had to actually come from within the organization. And one thing you know about anything that has to come from within the organization is that people in departments are not going to release their best people to go somewhere else. They will release their worst people to go somewhere else. So that was a fundamental problem. Secondly, it's only charged with actually dealing initially with two countries, Sierra Leone and Burundi. And that too means that there are a huge number of really important conflicts in which it won't have any real role to play at all. But perhaps the single most difficult problem is that when the initial negotiations over its agenda, one of those things that happens so frequently in the UN, you find a word which is very, very vague that everybody can agree to. So everybody agrees to it. And then when it actually comes to doing things in practice, all the disagreements that were hidden in that abstract word come back bubbling back out to the surface again. And that's what's actually happening at the moment. So, I mean, I think it's in principle a good idea. It's about coordination. It's a sort of a peace-building equivalent of the Interagency Standing Committee for Humanitarian Affairs. These things are good ideas in principle. Translating them into practice is incredibly difficult. It's going to take a long time.
Thanks to Dick Ruffin's question, can collaboration be done between major countries? Is it done these days? I mean, I think it's partly a matter of culture and mindset, but it certainly can be done, and it has been done. And when great things get done in foreign policy and diplomacy, it's usually because of that kind of hands-on coordination. I mean, take any case you might think of where there was a significant, sustained diplomatic initiative. I don't want to embarrass you, Dick, but your efforts in Cambodia and Southeast Asia at the end of the Cold War involved nonstop, 24/7, 365, inter-allied, inter-partner coalition building and maintaining communications channels open. That's what it takes. It takes that kind of determination, whether it's centralized in the United States or in some other country, is the issue. We're facing it right now in Afghanistan as to how sustainable is the effort there within a NATO context. So it's a matter of will and it's a matter of leadership.
Kind of short. Hi, Ella Vindura. I'm an associate professor at George Mason University. I wish to begin my question with a disclaimer, actually two disclaimers. First, I'm an educator. I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a diplomat, no ambitions of that sort. But I'm an educator who somehow believes in the power of education to transform lives and mediate peace among communities and nations. The second disclaimer is that I know firsthand what conflict and violence are, as I am a Burundi native. Now a US citizen, but nevertheless, those are memories that have never gone away and never will. So therefore, for me, there is always a sense of urgency when we are talking about these important issues of conflict mediation and peace building. I feel like we need to do it right now. You know, don't waste time, don't go to sleep until something has been done. I have the impression that the way society stands at this point, we seem to be stuck in what I have called an either-or frenzy and rush to vengeance, which is completely devoid of the hard power that Professor Crocker mentioned. I was so pleased when he mentioned that concept of hard power, because it looks like it's missing in many of the decisions we make as a nation in the United States and other governments around the world. So here is my question. How can we use education to transform the discourse of conflict and exclusion to build the human capacities to live together? How can political scientists, for instance, and diplomats contribute to this transformative discourse of peace? And this is a question, anyone who dares to tackle that, I would really appreciate some inspiration. Thank you.
Ben?
I think people are looking at me because I teach, but I actually claim no particular knowledge on the role of education in broader development, especially towards peace building. So what I'll give you is kind of my own perspective and what I've seen anecdotally. Needless to say, I wouldn't do what I do if I didn't believe that education can play a huge role in changing how people think about complex issues. But the tremendous importance to me is ensuring that there is a very strong education system, in particular at the primary level, at the secondary level, that although there is an understandable focus, and that's where a lot of money goes, at institutions like my own, they're at the highest education levels. That's from a resource point of view, to me, that's not necessarily money best spent. What's amazing to me is actually how often higher education programs seem to fail when individuals leave those places and go back to their countries of origin, where the dynamics of the local struggle seem to sweep them up. And there's always a kind of amazed story in some leading U.S. newspaper about, you know, Prime Minister so-and-so or Defense Minister so-and-so, comma, who was educated in the United States, comma, who nevertheless seemed to be involved in horrible corruption or horrible atrocities. So where I see education as having the greatest role is not necessarily educating a single leader or an elite, but trying to educate large swaths of the citizenry to have the ability to better themselves economically and socially, and that over time will have huge societal effects, and that's where I would put my emphasis.
If I could say a word about journalism, I think everybody knows what a perilous state my profession is in, and particularly the problem with newspapers no longer having as many foreign correspondents abroad as they used to, not sending people abroad as often as they used to. This is an enormous problem. We're going through this structural churning with the internet and so on, and you know, websites are very nice and blogs are very nice, but they're not going to pay your airfare to go to Iran and interview people. So I think this is a real problem that we're becoming much less well educated as a society, certainly in this country. Young people don't read newspapers, and editors are so desperate to sell newspapers that they sometimes reduce issues to very simplistic terms. Everything becomes who's winning. Everything becomes this, you know, who's up, who's down. Conflict sells more than peace. And I think that's one of the things that my profession needs to address. Certainly one of the reasons I wrote the book was because I felt I wasn't able to express what I really knew about Iran and what needed to be told in just daily journalism. So I think something, you know, I don't want the government supporting journalism, but something has to be done to be able to support serious foreign correspondents, that's for sure.
A major reason we have these three, four, five, six, how many books is it? Is because Pamela's leadership of the education program and the work that Fenn, Pamela, and I have done is in part a reflection of a belief that putting into the covers of a book what can be done, what has been done, best practices, what the choices are, that sort of thing, is worthwhile for the primary American constituency. But Pamela, you're the one who should speak to this. What about the zones of conflict constituency? What is the role of education in zones of conflict? Are textbooks instruments of war, or are they instruments of peace?
I'll just say a word because I don't want to hijack this whole thing. I mean, we could be here for hours if you wanted to. They're really, and we do a lot of work in zones of conflict with educators, and there seems to be two particular focal points which both can cause problems and can help. Two points of intervention. One is with history textbooks. This isn't for outsiders to do, but to help the conflicting parties look at their own histories and how they're presenting their cases. Often they fight their battles through their history textbooks. So to shine a light on that, and also to engage with students at the university sector. I think there's a lot of desire to help transform primary and perhaps secondary education, but you often find that at the university level, this is where students are actually brought into political parties, and they form their political views for life. And so to engage with students at that level.
Again, a little bit promotion of the Institute's work before we go to the next questioner. Training young people to be elites is a critical aspect of building through education the capacity for the leadership that you need. And whether it's our work in the high schools or at more senior levels, or the funding that we give to an operation like Seeds of Peace, which is designed in the case of the Arab-Israeli context to create young people who are oriented towards seeing themselves as conflict managers is one important educational role. The other is track to dialogue. And you get young people or even seasoned diplomats who can talk to one another offline, and that if the leadership is right, and you can't downplay the importance of those in political power, But if they have, if there is support for the people in the private sector to play these roles, then education can make a difference.
My name is Faribors Frank Fouladi. I'm a Muslim, Persian native, and a Marylander. You know, Annapolis is our capital. I hope we would not be a photo opportunity in Annapolis. Procurement USA established September 14, 2001. We believe that a cash free procurement is the key for not providing, making states within the states. Because, for example, we know there are a lot of cash going on with different people who are creating states within states and making different their ideas. You cannot say Iran is one country, it's many states within one country. So cash-free procurement is, we thought it would be the key. In order to defuse the terrorism, food, shelter, healthcare, and education is the key. In Montgomery County, Maryland, we achieved that by providing opportunity for people to provide food, shelter, healthcare, and education for themselves. How about going from, instead of looking at macro level of peace, how about working micro level from county government to the larger governments? So let people know America is a good place, and meet us in a micro level and a sub macro level. I'd like to get your opinion on that.
I think your question is whether peace has to be built from the top down or from the bottom up. Is that partly what it is? In the post-Cold War period, of course, the barriers to entry in terms of third parties getting involved in conflict have gone down substantially, to the point that there are hundreds, not to say thousands, of NGOs, non-official actors, operating at many different intervention points, civil society influentials, youth, women's groups, elders groups, religious groups, but also at the community and village level. And I think there's no simple answer to your question except to say there's a lot of people engaging at lots of levels. At a certain point in time, some of that engagement needs to be coordinated. And one of the biggest problems that can arise is the lack of a clearinghouse or a gateway for all these different initiatives. But at grassroots, I would say the door is open. I don't know if others want to comment on that.
Agreed.
Hi, I'm Carla Winston. I work here at the Institute. We've heard a bit today about the changing nature of warfare and the problems in Iraq not really being military and the ways that third parties and other types of groups engage in conflict now. I understand the Human Security Report Project has a new brief coming out on the costs of war that are not just, you know, budgets and battle deaths. Where are there opportunities for us to look at not separate issues, but adjacent issues and parallel issues and non-traditional and non-conventional drivers of conflict and problems with peace building and prevention? Where are we not using our full toolkit that we really should be looking at?
You know, I'll take a bash at it just by giving one example. I mentioned in my remarks that the North-South Agreement called the CPA in Sudan was a significant act of statecraft and a successful act of statecraft in bringing to an end one dimension of a 20-year war, which really was more like a 50-year war, because Sudan has not been at peace since August of 1955, when people began to realize that the British flag was coming down. This was a major accomplishment. But signing the piece of paper is the beginning of a process, not the end of the process. And what we're all looking to see, and I have enormous respect for those who are working this issue in our government, but we need to see a sense of who's in charge of the implementation. It's not self-implementing. The Sudanese are not going to implement it by themselves. Why? Because the agreement provides for the right of self-determination. So the two sides are most likely, if left to their own devices, and they've got lots of devices, to game the agreement for their own interests. You need external, highly coordinated, and frankly quite intrusive implementation of this very complex structure. And then along comes Darfur, and Darfur takes about 90% of the oxygen out of the room whenever anyone talks about Sudan. So it's a problem. It's a problem demanding world-class statesmanship, implementation. There's some good people involved, but it's not ever clear to me whose hands are on the bus, on the steering wheel of the bus from day to day.
I think it's a really good and very, very interesting question. One of the things that people often say to us, well, you know, what about indirect deaths? What about the war-exacerbated disease and malnutrition? Where is your data on that? Yeah. And the answer is there isn't any. There is only one country in the world where you've had a group of epidemiologists going back systematically since 1998 looking at indirect deaths, and that's in the DRC with the International Rescue Committee. And what they figure is about 3.9 million people, is their most recent estimate, have died who wouldn't have died if there hadn't been a war. Unbelievable. Iraq, what are the estimates of direct deaths in Iraq? They range from 70,000 to the most recent estimate coming from a British poll, but 1.2 million. I mean, there's a huge debate about that. There's a huge debate within the epidemiological community. The amount of resources that get put into doing this are unbelievably small and inconsequential. We believe that every time there is a post-conflict peace-building mission going out, one of the first things that should happen is that it should be a major nationwide health survey, the sort of thing that the demographic and health surveys are done by the U.S. The cost would be, you'd be talking somewhere between $1 and $2 million to do a really good, large numbers of cluster sample. But getting governments to be prepared to pay for data is incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. As I showed in that graph there, the fact that the terrorism statistics are so all over the place. I mean, huge differences between three institutions funded by the United States government, and no real attempt for those people to get together and say, hey, we've got real differences here. How do we explain them? It's quite extraordinary. The second area, I think, where there's an enormous problem area is impact evaluation. The UN never does impact evaluation. The UN is a culture, it's a culture that's run by lawyers and diplomats. No offense to lawyers and diplomats, but if you're going to do systematic impact evaluations, they need to be systematic, and they need resources, and those resources are almost never there. The bank's much, much better at doing this. Because the bank's an institution basically run by economists, and they sort of think in terms of impact evaluation. But even there are fundamental challenges, and there's a huge debate going on there about impact evaluation as well. So I guess my feeling on that... Oh, and one last thing on the cost of war. If you look at the indirect cost of war, if Charles Taylor goes out and kills or is responsible for direct deaths of 10,000 people, he can get hauled up in front of an ad hoc tribunal. The future Charles Taylor's maybe the ICC. But if the same Charles Taylor is directly responsible for the indirect deaths of 100,000 people, no one cares. Nobody does anything about it. Human rights organizations do anything about it. There's a huge culture of impunity about that, where the majority of deaths that occur as a consequence of war, which are the nonviolent deaths, so-called, there is simply nothing done about them at all. And that's one of the reasons why we want to focus that on the report we're bringing out next year.
All right, two final questions.
Yeah, Monty Marshall, George Mason University, I guess. Also with the U.S. government's political instability task force, which means I have a list of about 100 questions here. I'm going to whittle it down to maybe three comments and two questions. We're also interested in this whole issue of what to expect and how to manage the problems in the world system and the prospects of war and unleashing the dogs of war. And Andy's pointed out that we made enormous progress since the end of the Cold War, and this is really good. What we're left with, however, is really bad. We've gotten rid of all the easy ones, and the really hard ones are left. We have 12 protracted conflicts that have been going on for 10, 30, 60 years that defy resolution. And how we're going to resolve these is an enormous problem. And as your graphs point out, we've bottomed out. My graphs also show evidence that we have leveled off. We're not making the kind of progress that we have in the past. So as we're always looking to understand these dynamics and how to best treat them, You know, the one issue that comes up with Africa is the best illustration. That's where conflict has dropped off the most. The issues of poverty and marginalization, and the whole issue of the cost of war and the humanitarian crises and indirect deaths. I mean, this is the emblematic the Africa situation. And the UN has taken enormous steps to try and alleviate the problem of poverty and the maldistribution of income in the world system. And we've charted it's almost perfect inequality of income in the world system. This gives us pause. Whatever we can do to eliminate the problem of marginalization will bring down those battle deaths, because, you know, people die mainly because people don't care whether they live, and other problems are more pressing. Dan points out to this, or I think it was Dan, perhaps it was someone else, the bipolar worldview with the global war on terrorism, and I guess it wasn't Dan, this was probably Chet, Chester, sorry. Apply familiarity here. And Chet, I said hello to Chet. Sorry. This whole war in Iraq is really diverting attention and energy and resources. I mean, enormously consuming situation and really dampening our efforts on the poverty and marginalization effort. But what it really points out to is the real new dynamic of the bipolar world, and that's between consumers and producers of oil. And this is the question, the number one question. I think I made three comments. The number one question, is the UN, Andy, capable of initiating a conference of world leaders to really deal with the global energy problem? And not only the energy consumption and production problem and this bifurcation, which is really driving the tension and leading us to war in these places like Iraq and Iran. But also the global warming problem, which is the problem that we're starting to recognize as the most serious environmental problem of the next generation. What can the UN do? Can the UN do anything, especially given that we now are engaging in a U.S. World order? And when we study the conflict dynamics, a lot of the dynamics we're finding right now is, as was pointed out, the issue that the U.S. wants the world to fall into a world order that we've designed, and they're not seeing that as necessarily in their best interests. And there is a rising resistance to this, not very well organized, but extremely deadly and disruptive. So what you know, what can we really do anticipating these next problems?
Let me just say a couple of things, Monty. First of all, Monty's work in this area and those of his colleagues, I think, is remains underappreciated. It has been extraordinary. We've learned an enormous amount from it. I mean, I think the issue you raised there, what is it that the UN can do? Could the UN convene a conference in a sense that was about a number of the fundamental challenges which issue with respect to global energy? And the answer is, don't say the UN. You're talking about that would be something that would have to get the go-ahead from the Security Council, and the Security Council really means the P5. And my guess is, without actually knowing it, the Chinese would look at this and they say, whoa, wait a minute. You know, we're involved, pushing very, very strongly wherever we can to get access to resources which we desperately need. We think that there's likely to be resistance from the Americans. And it may be possible, but it would be extremely difficult. Of course, you've got the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is actually a UN institution. But one of the reasons it's been successful is that because it's been insulated from UN politics. It is much, much more a technical, scientific organization than it is a political one. And the problem with the United Nations is, I mean, the UN. I mean, you can look at the UN in terms of the General Assembly, which actually has a lot of power, because the General Assembly's power arises in terms of allocating funds to things, and that's critical. And, you know, the UN's been compared to being a corporation with 200 highly activist directors on it. Incredibly difficult to work. The Council is easier to work, but then the Council, precisely because it's easier to work, is seen as being unrepresentative, which it is. And there are still fundamental differences which separate the P5 members. So, I mean, I think you can never look at the UN as an institution would always look at the Security Council. It's the collective of states. And because it's so difficult to get agreement on these things, I suspect that we probably aren't going to get the sort of things that you think and I think would be a good idea for the foreseeable future.
Last comment, question.
Hi, my name is Joanna Yu. I'm a graduate student at SAIS, just around the corner on Massachusetts Avenue. And I understand this talk is mostly about Middle East and how smart power can kind of control war. But if you don't mind, I want to ask about East Asia. It just seems that conflict, the idea of conflict management doesn't really extend to East Asia right now, specifically to China. And one of the hotspots in East Asia is the Taiwan Strait. And you have, you know, the Chinese seeing Taiwan as an issue of national unification. You have the Taiwanese seeing the issue as the Chinese using very aggressive tactics to undermine its international standing. I'm just wondering, could the full spectrum of statecraft and also like the tools of conflict management could be used to deconflict that region, especially when the U.S. is kind of more and more asked to play the referee backed up by military power?
I'd make a quick comment. Maybe others in the panel would like to as well.
One more thing. I actually will also invite the moderator, Mr. Solomon, who will let me some comments too.
Maybe Dick should answer it. I would just say this: we are conducting a highly regionally dominated foreign policy today, focused on the Middle East, and so it's not surprising if you heard that from the panel. A lot of Middle Eastern examples. We need to be able to conduct a global policy. And Dick, over to you. How about some Asian policy?
One point, though, you know, we have subcontracted so much of our Asian diplomacy to the Chinese that it makes it more difficult, I think, for us to influence them over Taiwan. I mean, because of this administration's allergy to talking directly to people it doesn't like, we had the whole six-party process with the North Koreans, which, of course, only came to its current point because the U.S. and North Koreans finally sat down together and talked together at length. So I'm not sure what U.S. leverage is over Taiwan. I mean, my sense is that they're just hoping and praying that the Taiwanese will resolve it with the mainlanders without the U.S. having to do anything.
China, Taiwan, and the U.S. role within in that nexus is a bigger discussion other than to say I think the history will show that the U.S. has played a stabilizing, buffering role in the middle of the straits while economic, political, social changes have occurred that in fact are with the one question of how Mr. Chen Shui-bian plays out his term is likely to be stabilizing over the longer run, that you have political dialogue that you didn't have before. You have the mainland recognizing the value of the Taiwan economy. You have students from Taiwan going to the mainland for higher education, all sorts of links developing. And the United States has enabled that process to play itself out. And Chairman Mao told Richard Nixon that Beijing could wait 100 years to resolve the Taiwan issue. He said, well, eventually we're going to fight for it because there are a bunch of reactionaries over there. But I think letting the situation play out over time is still the view in Beijing as long as no one's hand is forced to unilaterally change the situation. And the notion that it's in Beijing's interest to fight the reactionaries on the island, I think that's clearly changing. The role that the U.S. and China are playing in the six-party talks, another issue of where I think the United States is playing. I mean, this is one area where I think the administration, while it may have come later than might have been done, has effectively created a multilateral mechanism to deal with North Korea. It may not be effective. I think the North Koreans, just as the Iranians, are going to be very, very reluctant to give up their nuclear programs, but I think the six-party talk framework has gotten us somewhere, and the Chinese, who have a tremendous interest in that situation on the peninsula remaining stable, have turned out to be helpful. Well, you've all been good, but the best, of course, is our panel here, and I want to have you join me in thanking them for a terrific morning.